This is Siegfried Berezov, and you're listening to Migrant Matters Radio here on CFRU 93.3 FM. And this is the radio interview I did with Michael Parenti, a progressive scholar, back in early July of this year. And I interviewed him on his recent book, The Face of Imperialism. So this is the interview. So, so everybody, this is Michael Parenti, progressive scholar based in Berkeley, California. And actually, Michael, I would like to talk to you right now about... You have your latest book, which came out earlier this year. It's called The Face of Imperialism. Am I right?
Correct.
That is correct. Okay. So I would like to begin just by asking, what is the, you could say, the face of imperialism in the modern world, you know, based on the title of your book there? Because, you know, the picture that we get, you know, that a lot of people have of empire, of imperialism, is they think the old bygone colonial empires of the, say, the 19th century and whatnot, they think of it almost as an anachronistic concept. So what does imperialism look like today?
Well, in fact, in the literature today, it's not anachronistic. There are book after book using the term empire, Twilight of Empire, Follies of Empire, The Search of Empire, and all sorts of. And they're all about how America has a global dominion and has a mission and is doing something that's very right or very wrong or whatever, but in any case mistaken and such. And I argue that the U.S. empire is very rational. It's very successful. It's led by people who know what they're doing. And what they're doing is to expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the capital and the trade of the entire world, expropriate all of that for the profits of the multinational corporations to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. And they're very successful at what they do, and they're very rational. And the dictators in the Middle East, for instance, who support that arrangement, who bring in the IMF, who open up their country for U.S. investments on terms that are totally advantageous to the investors at a cost to their own people, their own farmland, their own farmers, their own consumers, their own workers. Those dictators are supported. They're called friends of the United States. Mubarak was called that, right, to the last, until he couldn't be legitimately supported anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton were calling him a friend who had stability and all that. He was a dictator for 30 years, but he was their dictator, you see. But now the dictator, and the other kind of dictator, the one who has some idea of self-development for his country and self-determination, someone who refuses to deal with the IMF, who uses the resources, the oil earnings of the country, kicks out the oil companies like Gaddafi's done in Libya, kicks out the oil companies and uses the earnings for free housing, free education, for building up that marvelous public aquifer from the south of Libya, bringing up all that beautiful, clean, pure water for consumption and for farming and development. A leader like that is demonized. Hello, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A
leader like that is demonized in the U.S. media, and the demonization of the leader justifies then, it gives the empire license to bomb and kill his people. That you demonize Noriega and you can invade Panama and kill people there. 3,000 people bombed and killed in El Chadi, a working-class neighborhood. You demonize Milosevic, and you can bomb for 78 days and nights. Bill Clinton did bomb Yugoslavia and break it up. And I was in Yugoslavia 2 weeks after all the bombing ended. And I saw the terrible destruction that took place there. It was privatization by bombing. They hit only state-owned auto utility factories, hotels and such, only the state-owned ones. The private ones went unscratched, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So this empire is there dedicated to making the world safe for big private capital and corporate capital, and that's what it's about. Instead, what we get is a literature which says how U.S. policy is confused, how it's inept, how it's well-meaning but misdirected, how it has a messianic mission that's leading it astray, how it's beset by unintended consequences, how it's this and that. And, of course, sometimes there are unintended consequences. I'm not ruling that out of history.
Oh, yeah.
But I argue in the face of empire that, in fact, it's not inept. It's not the people who own and control most of the world, you know, are not inept. They're getting richer and richer, and the people, the ordinary people of the world, are getting poorer and poorer. The number of people living in poverty in the world is growing at a faster rate than the world's population, which is growing quite fast as it is.
Yeah.
So you see, things aren't getting better. And we see that same thing right within the U.S. People say to me, why, you mean American policy, they would go and do all that just to destroy these people's social programs and privatize everything in their countries and expropriate all their resources and increase the gap between the rich and the poor? You think that's what the policy is dedicated to in all these corners of the world? I said, well, that's what it's dedicated to in the U.S. That's what free market policy is about. Here, that's exactly what they're doing here. They're cutting back on social programs. They cut back on taxes to the rich. They cut back. Wages have gone flat and not keeping up. And meanwhile, the rich few get, the super rich get richer and richer, and the rest of us must work harder and harder to stay in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place.
Not staying in the same place.
You're slipping back, yeah.
Well, certainly what I've seen, you know, being up here in Canada, you know, we're seeing the rise of a conservative right wing that's, in many cases, trying to demolish the gains that have been made by working people over the years and, you know, almost move us closer to, like, what you're seeing, I guess, in the United States.
Yes, rolling back the gains that have been won,
hard-fought
gains.
Yeah, and it's quite sad to see them, you know, really making a very, very serious and quite frightening bid for power in Ontario itself, which is where I am. And, of course, they've already gained a majority in Parliament. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about was indeed Libya. And because in Libya, certainly I think it was on RT just the other day, RT America, which actually broadcast apparently the bombings, the effect of the NATO bombings, which, of course, has been catastrophic on the infrastructure of that country. The only thing they have not hit has actually been the oil refineries. You know, that's like the only thing that remains untouched in a lot of these places, like, say, Brega or Ashdod.
Right, because they're anticipating, taking over the oil countries, but oil industries.
Infrastructure, yeah.
Right.
So
yes, in Libya and under the guise of humanitarian war, which is to go in and stop the savage slaughter of innocents, supposedly by the Gaddafi people. Well, by the way, charge that's never really been proven.
Right.
You know, but so they've been bombing the utilities, they've been bombing the factories, they've been bombing the ports, the transportation systems. They're destroying the country, and they've been killing a lot of innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been committing acts of war. Those are all acts of war when you bomb a country, bomb its facilities, and kill its people. And they also have perpetrated a blockade of Libya. A blockade is an act of war. When one country blockades another country, that first country is committed an act of war. Because what you've done is you've cut off the other country's lifeline to all commerce, and whatever else. You're committing an act of aggression against the other country's commerce and ability to survive.
And
that's what's happening
now.
And we have so-called progressive people who are lined up and are standing shoulder to shoulder with the CIA and the Pentagon and the White House and NATO and the major media, who they always tell us don't believe and be critical of, and they themselves are believing every damn story that's come out. They're believing it. They got Susan Price, U.S. ambassador, who says Gaddafi feeds his troops Viagra before they go into battle.
I've heard that.
They're better able to rape. What level of story is this? It's like the crap we used to hear with Yugoslavia, that there was a Serbian general who told his troops, go forth and rape. And those of us who said, what general? Where did this happen? What were the army units that were asked to do? Nobody came up with anything. It was
where's the evidence?
No such thing. It was just a story fabricated, and it's repeated again and again. And this is what they do. And these are called humanitarian wars. And these leaders are demonized, And there are some people on the left, some of them just think they're fighting the ghost of Stalin, I guess. Mm. I don't know. Others who just think they are, for some reason, they just believe the bourgeois capitalist media without a second thought.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things I really wanted to mention, of course, was Greece. You know, what's going on there? Because, I mean, does that factor into your study of imperialism, you know, where you have the IMF actually going in and essentially doing this whole, like, privatization campaign, really, you know, essentially forcing, you know, the government of a country really to do its bidding in that sense and just, you know, essentially demolish, you know, every human service you can possibly think of. You know?
Right. And that's
not necessarily war.
Privatize everything. Yes, that's exactly what they were doing in Libya, too, but it wasn't going fast enough, and there wasn't enough of it, and Gaddafi was managing to still keep the other gains that he had won in the first 30 years. But he saw what had happened to Iraq, and so he got so frightened that he started making SAPs, too, you know, structural adjustment programs, which meant concessions in the amount of money spent for human services and all that, and he began to do some privatization or giving capital some more room. BP was going to have a consortium with him on the oil. So he was making these concessions, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't really a free market sweep, and that's what they're going to do. And they're using Greece, the same thing. Greece is going to get a bailout. Well, there's no bailout. You know what a bailout is? It's just a debt, that's all. It's just lending more money to the country, but it's not in any way helping Greece. And you lend the money, it's a kind of blackmail. You know, we'll give you the money to meet the payments, and what you got to do now is hand over all the communication industry, the transportation industry, anything that might be in the public domain. And these are the very things. These are the things that have to be wiped out because they're socialistic. And it's a funny thing. What they demonstrate is that socialism works. A socialized post office works more efficiently and better than a privatized one. I remember the U.S. post office used to be completely publicly owned. It wasn't broken up in sectors and all that.
Right.
It was publicly owned and used to get deliveries two times a day, 6 days a week, and it was fine. It was one of the best postal services there are. Today it's much tougher on workers, much more expensive, and much of it is going into private hands. And that process of privatizing the post office started with Nixon. Well, it showed the post office worked better when it was socialist. Railroads in Europe work better when they're government-run and government-owned than Amtrak when it's privately owned and it's milked. It's milked for private profit. How can you expect to get something good out of a system like health service or transportation or hospitals and such when the function or schools? When the function, the primary function, is to extract as much profit as possible by private corporate owners, then you're not going to get the kind of services you need. Private ownership might be better for, you know, a specialty restaurant or something, or some other, I don't know, a fashion house or something.
Yeah.
But or some small service businesses, I can see where private ownership might have a role, and small business might have a role, but the problem with capitalism is their enmity towards socialist or publicly owned services. What they hate about publicly owned services is that they do work, and that's why they don't want them. That's why they're trying to destroy Social Security in the United States,
because
it does work. It's the most successful anti-poverty program that we have in this country. You never miss a Social Security check. The administrative costs for Social Security are about 2% of the total intake on it. I mean, vastly less than private insurance. Private insurance is more like 20-30%, because that has to go for profits, advertising, and all the stuff that they do. So this is what the war is. It's really a war to defend, extend, and expand the free market capitalism. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most of the people, even people who say they are left and progressive and such, don't seem to understand that or ever carry it that far. Instead, they talk about how stupid this president is, or how silly that is, or how contradictory these are. You know, here's one dictator you support, and there's another dictator you oppose, and why can't they be as smart as we are? And the fact is, they're really stupid. They don't know what the hell they're talking about half of the time, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Well, I mean, yeah, and you can see, of course, this process in your own communities. I mean, in our own communities, considering that, you know, Canada, one of the things it's absolutely renowned for is, of course, this whole, like, single-payer, publicly owned healthcare system.
Right.
And, of course, that's being undercut. Of course, it's been under attack in Ontario for quite a long time. I know when I was a kid, certainly is a point in this, the town I'm in, Guelph, had two hospitals, two emergency wards, you know, and it was much smaller then. Now, of course, it's a city of 120,000 people and growing, and it only has one emergency ward. You know, that was because of the cuts made by a conservative government for really the reasons you just pointed out. So, you know, it's like we, you know, these left critics, I mean, like we see this everywhere. And, you know, honestly, I think we should open our eyes.
The same thing in the UK, right?
In
Britain, the private utility companies, electric companies, the top managers got their salaries doubled and tripled and quadrupled. The services were cut back and were inferior to what they had been before, and the rates were much higher. So you're paying more and getting less. That's what the secret of capitalism is.
Oh yeah.
And they talk about how the free market can do it better. No, it can't. What it can do better is put up a big cloud of propaganda about what it supposedly does or doesn't do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually want to shift gears now because there was another thing I actually wanted to talk to you about. Because we know this is very relevant, what you talked about with the face of imperialism. You know, you've shown how relevant that is in the present day here. But I want to talk to you about kind of more historical book, which you wrote, of course, back in 2003, I believe it came out, which is the Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, which I actually talked about back in March. I had my co-host here, and we actually did a whole show more or less analyzing Julius Caesar as a popular leader back then, kind of like this reformist figure, which, of course, not many people know him in that light. But I wanted to know what really inspired you to explore that, because it's one of those things that's not immediately obvious. Like, everybody thinks they know what the score is with Julius Caesar. You know, he's like this guy who destroyed the Roman Republic, and he was like this evil, you know, guy who wanted power for power's sake. And that seems to be, you know, the common opinion, you know, displayed by historians all across the board. So what was it that ultimately led you to do that work, to write that book?
Well, Siegfried, the only thing I find more intriguing and exciting than learning history is unlearning history.
Mm.
That is, unlearn the things that I thought were true and suddenly discovering, wait a minute, wait, that isn't it at all. And we were taught that Julius Caesar was murdered by these aristocrats because they so loved their beloved republic and he was usurping power. And that was nonsense. These guys backed every emperor that came afterwards.
Mm.
They supported the emperors because the emperors never imposed taxes on their wealth, never imposed luxury restrictions, never forced them to hire free labor instead of slave labor, never imposed rent controls on the big tenement houses they owned in Rome, and never imposed on them land reform and giving the land back to small landholders. And Caesar did all of those things, and that's what they hated about him, and they said it. I found letters that have been ignored by just about every historian. I mean, I didn't find the originals. They're all, it's in print. I mean, it's printed in books.
It's in print, yeah.
Caesar, yeah, a letter by Cicero to Atticus, his rich friend Atticus, where he says, you know, we killed Caesar, but the things we hated are still here. And so it wasn't that they, and these historians write these silly stories. They hated him because one time they went to visit him and he failed to rise to greet them. Or they hated him because he slept with a few of their wives. I mean, give me a break. They were all sleeping with each other's wives. The Roman matrons got around. I mean, they made up lost time or mismarriages in no time. Even Clodius slept with Caesar's wife, and they were allies. They, so, So, I mean, these stupid kinds of gossipy things of history. And I said, here's this whole issue where they very clearly were ready to sacrifice this republic at any time and have a monarch. But he was the wrong, again, he was the wrong kind of dictator, which, by the way, is a Roman term. And it means a leader expropriating unusual power for a temporary period to get something done and ram it through, you know.
Fast track.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I had a great time delving and dipping into it. And I was fascinated by the way historians of that day built up this myth that Caesar was just somebody who was threatening the Republic, and Brutus and Cicero and these fellows had to save the Republic. That was a phony issue. They hated the Republic to the extent that it worked, to the extent that the Senate controlled most of the important decisions, they went along with the Republic. But they hated the Tribunate. They hated the Tribunes, who were the popular leaders who could actually veto most Senate decisions or many Senate decisions. They hated any consul who was elected who started doing things that were for the people, like Tiberius Gracchus and his younger brother. So the evidence was so overwhelming that why Caesar was killed had something else to do. But those historians are echoed today all through the centuries. Mm. And modern day historians repeat these same little anecdotal claptrap stories to explain class conflict. Anything but facing the realities of class conflict, you see. Caesar was one of a group of senators and other leaders, like the Gracchi brothers, like Clodius and the others, who not to be confused with Claudius, who came later.
Oh, right, yeah.
But they were part of what were called the populares, which was a Roman word for demagogue, which come down to us now as democratic leaders, you know. And these populares really fought for social reforms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was about. By the way, could I recommend to your listeners that they take a visit to my website, which is michaelparenti.org, and that some of these things are summarized there, and they can look at the books and the articles and the like.
Yeah, I certainly found that book absolutely fascinating. I mean, because one of the things I do on this show, like quite a lot, is I try to really go back into history and look at it from like a perspective that you don't get in, like, say, mainstream textbooks. I certainly have a history degree myself, but I noticed things, you know, as I was going through the, I was actually at the University of Guelph, and going through the undergraduate curriculum. It's like the first course which you have to take is called Europe in the Age of Expansion, you know, and this is about like imperialism, but they kind of cloak it.
They call it expansion, not imperialism.
This language, right? And right. You don't really get the perspectives of the people who are on the receiving end of this so-called expansion.
Right.
You know?
No, you never get that perspective, how their villages are burned, how their farms and how their people are summarily mass murdered and the like.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And so, like, you don't find out that. So, I mean, yeah, it's...
I never learned that about the... Well, here in the U.S., we used to get American history, and there was a chapter called The Winning of the West.
Winning of the West.
No, it didn't tell us it was genocide, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's all covered up, right?
Yeah.
But certainly, in the case of Caesar, you must see parallels between what happened to him and, of course, what happened to, say, popular leaders in, you know, right up until the present day. I think you mentioned Pinochet and Allende. That was the example that you used.
Same thing that happened to Allende, and Noriega and Milosevic and Gaddafi today, and any number of democratic leaders have been assassinated and such. That goes on. They know who to kill, from Malcolm X to JFK, who was doing some very minor changes and such, and they whacked him.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, you can, as I say, your listeners can maybe check it out
on the website. That has information about all your books and talks.
And Parenti is spelled Parent with an I, Michael Parenti, one word, .org.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show here with us tonight.
Well,
and,
thank you.
Yeah, and this it really has been a pleasure. Very informative.
Right.
So, thank you very much for being on our program.
Bye-bye.
Bye.